This is Catherine Murphy interviewing Evelyn Nelson for the Heritage Education Commission Oral History Project on November 5, 1985 at Morehead State University. Evelyn was the business manager for the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra from 1967 until 1984, and it is that association of hers that we primarily want to discuss today. Evelyn, first, could we find out some biographical information about you? Where were you born?
Well, I was born in Gary, Indiana. My parents were immigrants from Europe. And, of course, Gary was a melting pot of immigrants from Europe at that time. And I grew up there and went to high school, graduated from high school, and started working relatively quickly, but went to community college at night in Gary. And during that time, I also got serious about a young man who I married. And when he went overseas, I went back to school at his suggestion and went to the University of Chicago until he came back. And I finished a PhD in at the university, and then he went to school, so then ensuing years we
finished up. In what field? What did you study?
Well, I didn't, at that time, Chicago's undergraduate degree was in just liberal arts studies, mm-hmm. and so it was just a straight liberal arts study. I had taken a business course in Gary, Indiana, after I got out of high school, just to give me some background, but I did just have liberal arts, so I wasn't mm-hmm. really trained for anything. I had gone into the School of Social Service when he had come back, but it was agreed that, you know, I should get a job and try to help bring in the paychecks during the time he was in school, and he went to school and became, got his degree in English, and so we came up here in 1953 after he had finished his master's and most of his, I guess, did all the coursework for his PhD.
And Ray has been a faculty member.
Yes, he's been a faculty member at Concordia ever since that time, mm-hmm. and he's professor of English, and mm-hmm. he was chairman of the Department of English for about 6 years, a few years back.
Well,
so we're well entrenched.
Well, right. You're definitely permanent residents then. Well, you've had a long and fruitful association with one of our major arts institutions in our area, the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony, and we're primarily interested in that relationship and your observations that cover a period of time for this historical record. How did you get involved with the symphony?
Well, I got involved very ridiculously to start. When Walter Prausnitz came down to interview Ray for coming up to Concordia, he asked if I could play an instrument, and I very kiddingly said, yes, violin, because I had taken violin when I was in seventh grade or something like this in school, and not really ever thinking, you know, he would take me seriously, but I didn't realize what a serious musician Walter was, and he did, and of course, when he came back, he told Sig and Isabel Thompson, Sig was the conductor, and Isabel Thompson was the concert mistress, and said, I've got a new violinist for you.
Oh, dear.
And when I came up, and they said, oh, you're the new violinist. And I said, what do you mean, the new violinist? And they said, well, we understand you play the violin. And I said, well, you know, I play just like, you know, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star sort of thing. But I don't think they ever believed me until one time Isabel handed me a violin and heard me draw the bow very badly over a few strings. And I think she realized that I was no violinist, but of course I did love music as a non-musician, and of course all those years after, we were very interested in what they did, and we went to a number of concerts at Central High over in Fargo, and just knew a lot of the people who were involved at that time in the symphony activities, the group that Sig and Isabel were friends with, and so I just kept that interest, and then when Walter had, he who had been volunteer manager for a number of years, and he was going overseas in 1967, so he had suggested to the search committee that they might contact me, that I might just possibly be interested in a part-time job at that time that would be something of interest to me and something that perhaps I could work with, and So they came over and asked if they could interview me, and I said yes. And so I took the job on a part-time basis, which, Walter, that was about 30 hours a month. And I, you know, I guess I just thought, well, that wasn't really bad. It was just about what I'd like. And because I had two young children, and so I thought, well, that would be an ideal setup. But what happened was when I took over on the 1st of July, I started in June of 67 and did just a few things like the summer concert and then. That wasn't too bad. But August 1st, he left, so then I was doing the work full-time. And all of a sudden, we found out that Jack Benny was coming. And this was something evidently the board had been working on for years, but never thought it probably would materialize. And all of a sudden, they got a call saying, you know, he would be willing to come in September. And so here I'm starting this job, and all of a sudden, I'm told, you know, Jack Benny's coming, and we'll have to change all the programming that had been planned for September and work out all of this. So within, I guess, about 5 to 6 weeks' time, we had to do everything that, you know, some big thing like this would have taken months of preparation normally. And but fortunately, it was a wonderful board. Noel Gogstetter was the president at that time. And there were a number of people who rallied around. John Paulson decided he could handle most of the publicity and have all the contact with the papers and the other news media in the area. And we had everybody just pitch right in. In fact, the board was running errands. I've just never seen a board quite work like that, and I was very impressed. But we put in literally hundreds of hours of work in those short times.
Yes, what happened to the 30 hours a month?
Oh, well, I just thought, you know, of course it was exciting and dramatic, but I just thought, oh, I didn't know whether I could continue this if it kept on at this pace. But we did clear about $8,000, and that was the start of our not quite an endowment fund, but we put it in a special fund to help bring up the orchestra remuneration and upgrade that. And I think it was the beginning of making plans for the future that we just had not been able to do.
A real turning point.
It was
probably
a very, very tremendous turning
yes.
point. And it was an exciting time, of course. Having somebody like Jack Benny here was just wonderful.
Well,
and
of course.
We had a packed house. It was the one time, until we started many years later to charge admission, it was the one time they did charge for that, because it was a benefit concert. Mm-hmm. And we had a special conductor circle type of section where all those people who bought tickets would go to a reception for Jack Benny over at the Fargo Country Club. And they could do that at that time for the magnanimous sum we thought of $12.50, which was really very small when you consider what ticket prices are today. But that was a very steep price at that time, and that was well attended. There were just all kinds of people at that, and he was just very gracious and talked to everybody who came up to him.
And did he play the violin in the
concert? Oh, he played the violin, you know, just, and he had several little setups with orchestra members, you mm-hmm. know, and it was a delightful evening, and I think everybody appreciated it.
Oh, yes. Where was it held? Was it at
It was
the
held
field
at Concordia.
At Concordia.
Uh-huh. And it was really the biggest field house we could handle mm-hmm. at that time, mm-hmm. where we could handle the chairs as we wanted to and that. And I would say there were about 2,500 people there, mm-hmm. and it was really just a real bang way to start off, you know, for me. We had a young man who was coming in at that time as a guest artist for the concert we had to cancel. And we, of course, had a signed contract, but fortunately the people, the booking agent was very kind and allowed us to bring him back the following year. They allowed us to cancel that contract by bringing him back the following year, which we did. And we were most appreciative that they gave us that flexibility,
that,
because many times you might have had to pay for the contract if you know, they were not too happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an exciting way to start off, and
well, that's
I think
real.
We kept running ever since. The growth after it that was very
sounds
good.
Sounds like a real baptism under fire to me.
It was, and it was
goodness.
Fun. But the board was really wonderful. And I think that has been one of the keys to the symphony over the years, is the excellent board.
The excellent they have board had. Support.
They yeah. have had very good board membership, and they've been very actively involved. They're a working board, and it's been a very good cross-section of the community. And they've had, I think now they've brought in a number of younger people, so that the age span is very good, and mm-hmm. They're both young and old in the, mm-hmm. on the board, and they all work together very well, and it has been an excellent board.
Well, that's a nice tribute to the importance of board leadership.
It certainly has
I think
been.
A lot of people don't understand how essential that is to
Well, they have to handle
an
all of the policies and mm-hmm. make the major decisions, and mm-hmm. And if you have somebody that you can work with well, and I think the board president and the conductor and the manager of an organization like a fine arts organization, I think they have to work just like a triumvirate. And really, if one of them, if it doesn't work well, then, you know, I think it creates problems in, mm-hmm. in functioning well. Mm-hmm. And I think when they work well, they can do great things.
You mentioned that early concerts had been given at the Fargo Central High School auditorium.
Well, I guess that was the home of the symphony for many, many years. Well, I guess at the very beginning they had concerts like at the Elks and the Moose and Chamber of Commerce setups and that, but I think eventually they got into the Fargo Central, and they performed there all the time until it burned down.
Mm-hmm.
Then when it burned down, they had to start using other facilities, and they used whatever they could get. I think they used NDSU Festival, and they used the Well Hall here, and Concordia, and some of the high schools. I know we had concerts, I think, at Shanley and that. So we really didn't have a home for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, when we started getting into where we had audiences of over 1,000, there just was no place to have them in the smaller auditoriums, so we ended up with having the concerts over at Concordia, because their permanent seating handles about 1,800.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able then to have most of the scheduling done there. We've done a few concerts on chamber concerts, I think, on MS campus and NDSU, but primarily the major concerts are now held at Concordia mm-hmm. because of audience size.
Well, that's a really significant audience number to attract, and it seems to me concerts are very well attended.
Yes, they are well attended. Mm-hmm. There. Makes you feel good to see mm-hmm. that section well filled, and sometimes they've even, you know, on the real popular concerts, especially when they've had some of the jazz people and that they've had to add seats on the floor, mm-hmm. and so that's also expandable, which is always very good. Although one will have to say one would like to see a real concert hall where the major groups like the symphony and the opera company could perform in a concert setup, you know.
Well, I certainly think that is a hope for the future in this community.
Yes, we hope that they'll keep working at that.
And it must have been very difficult for an organization like the symphony to have to move from one location to the next for successive concerts to set up.
Well, it is difficult, and we've been very fortunate, of course, in having three colleges here that have been very cooperative. I think if we hadn't had them, I don't know what we would have done, but they have been cooperative not only in letting us use facilities, but their equipment and their services, and the symphony has become very dependent on that kind of provision that has been made by the colleges to accommodate them, and it has been wonderful. I think the relationship between the colleges and the symphony has been very, very excellent.
Good. You mentioned some early people who were instrumental in directing and organizing the orchestra. You mentioned the Sigvald Thompsons, who were notable leaders, and Walter Prosnitz. Are there some other people from that earlier time
well,
you can recall?
Kurt Siegwald started originally Harry Rudd. When the orchestra started in 1931, Harry Rudd was made conductor. And he continued until 1937. And when Sig, who had been a cello player in the orchestra, had he had gone away to take, I think, 3 years at Juilliard. He studied composition at Juilliard, I believe, on a fellowship. He came back and was going to teach at Concordia. When he was here before, he was teaching at the Concordia Conservatory, but this time he came back to teach at the college, and he was also asked to take over the leadership of the orchestra. So he had been there from 1937 until 1974, so he was there for 37 years. And then Isabel, I guess, they had, my story as I understand is they had lost their concert mistress, and she happened to just be visiting because she's a Wahpeton girl. And she was Isabel Olson, and Isabel Olson Lloyd, and she was asked if she wanted to come down and maybe audition, help out, and she did, and stayed. And she, so she, this was in 1947, and she then also had put in 27 years before they retired. And she married Sig in 1948, and together they were sort of the first family of music in the Fargo-Moorhead area for many years, because they had hundreds of students on strings and had nurtured the orchestra and brought in as many of the good musicians as they could. And of course, many of the musicians were also teaching. So that was partly the reason why the orchestra kept building. They had materials that they really helped develop. It was sort of like an honor to get to look forward to your school training plus your private lessons to eventually get in the symphony. And there were many high school students when I first started. There were many more high school students than there are now. What's happened is that the youth symphony came in, and we felt that most of the high school students could play with that. Some very unusual musicians in high school have also played with the symphony, but they usually play with both groups, mm-hmm. and those are very dedicated musicians, mm-hmm. and so there still are a few high school musicians, but originally there were a great number of high school musicians, mm-hmm. and they developed, many of them stayed on at the colleges and then kept playing with the orchestra, so mm-hmm. they had many years. My own son started with Isabel when he was in second grade, on the Suzuki method, and then she changed, I think, the method of teaching after they had maybe 1 or 2 years. And so by the time he was, I think, in seventh or eighth grade, he had joined the symphony, and he played all the way through high school and all the way through college. And so that was a really fun experience.
Is he a musician today?
No, he no. isn't. He, but it, in fact, he was really kind of interested in sports in high school, but mainly maybe it was because he could do sports as well as he could play that he was able to do both, you know, mm-hmm. and as a result, he just disenjoyed it, and he, I think, once in a while picks up the fiddle and plays around with it, but he isn't. He's just too busy right now. And
well, what a
training.
Wonderful
but it
experience
was, he loved
for
it,
him.
And it was mm-hmm. Really great, and he still played in the high school orchestra. Most of all the musicians, they have to play in their high school orchestra, that they can't make choices mm-hmm. of saying, well, they'll only mm-hmm. play in the symphony if they play. Mm-hmm. But really now the ones that are playing are usually people who are playing the high school orchestra, and maybe there was some of their high school smaller groups, as well as the youth symphony plus the symphony. So they have spent many, many hours doing that, and it's a wonderful educational experience.
Well, I should say, many of the musicians are music faculty people also, are
yes.
they not?
I would say that today there are about 50% of the orchestra, which is usually is over 100 members. In fact, I think that in a total over a year's time, they've gone like 117 people or so have been members of the orchestra in one capacity or another. That about 50% of those are professional musicians, and the greater majority of them come from the college level. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they have many students who are studying with them, and so they encourage those students also. So the college contributes also a number of musicians to the orchestra, and of course the students get a tremendous experience in being able to play with those professionals and playing music that they might not quite have the opportunity to play on the college level, because the college level is playing at a slightly different level of music simply because of the different people who are playing in it. They mm-hmm. aren't all that proficient in music, and so these students have a very good opportunity to play some of the best works in symphonic works, as mm-hmm. well as play with musicians that are very professional, and yet sitting side by side, they have a lot to learn that way. Well, and they give a lot. Some of them yes. are excellent musicians themselves.
Well, it's a very productive interaction.
It really is
tremendous community.
Bloodlines going back and forth. You're right. Mentioning about other people in the past. There always have been a number of families in this community who have had more than one member playing in the orchestra, and that was true years back as well as now. And I think like in the 50s there were some major families, like the Gogstetter family had a number of children playing, the Chris Jensen family had a number, their boys were playing, and the Shickley family, the boys and the mother was playing, and the Strandness family had several members. And so there were a number of people who had, and there were a number of husband and wife teams. The Stern family was another one. I think mm-hmm. all of their children yes. played, including and the mother and father, Ed and his wife. And so that all of them have had a tremendous influence, I think, in the community, in terms of they were people who were active in the community as well. And so, you know, this stimulated interest. And today there are a number of husband and wife teams, and I think there is a mother and son team, and there are, you know, a good number of people also. So it makes you feel that people who are interested in music as a whole, that it often comes in family teams rather than just the one person in the family mm-hmm. who's interested. And I think that has been a very good influence on the orchestra.
Right. That's
even among the faculty members, there are husband and wife teams. You know, mm-hmm. sometimes the wife isn't the faculty member, but she maybe they were students together in college and that and had met, and so, you know, the wife is playing. And I think it's wonderful that they have a interest that is mutual to both and are able to share in it together, because mm-hmm. I'm sure this helps a great deal.
Well, it must be. What kind of time is involved for a musician playing in the orchestra?
Well, there are at least about 50 rehearsals a year, and there are in concerts. And those, you know, the rehearsals run about 2.5 hours, and so in the time going back and forth, it's giving a great deal of time, at least once a week. Nearly every week, and during the school year, that's from September through April, and then on the last week, there are usually like three rehearsals mm-hmm. and a concert, mm-hmm. so it's a concentrated effort on the last week of the, just prior to the concert. But when someone does do it, they have to have a lot of dedication. It's just not something they pick up and do when they want to. They know that to make the orchestra strong, they have to be there every time, and the professional people are really loyal. They're only not there is when they can't have a conflict in their own activities at the college or the school that they happen to be teaching at, and there's just no way that they can make an adjustment. But that happens very seldom, because usually mm-hmm. then they try to dovetail the activities of the college to fit in with the orchestra, because obviously the music activities on campuses or with the orchestra, if they conflict, they hurt each other, you know. So mm-hmm. I think we do have a tremendous cooperation between the administration of music faculties as well as the administrative office of the symphony to try to dovetail dates and that, so there aren't that many conflicts. But sometimes you just can't avoid them. A musical, for example, if the orchestra at one of the high schools is playing a musical, it's obvious that that person cannot be there. And he might say then, you know, he would like to be out of a whole concert rather than try to come in hit and miss, because it might be just easier to do that instead of trying to miss three or four rehearsals. Mm-hmm. But I would say on the whole that, you know, they're very dedicated to what they're doing. One of the questions that came up many years ago by one of the reporters is, well, you know, who is the clown? Who is the, you know, who's the slapstick person? That? And we kind of laughed because everyone is, when they come to rehearsals, they sit down, they're ready to play, and that's what they're there for. And we never, you know, you don't ever think, well, is someone clowning? Because there seems to never be time enough to just play music. And of course, everyone comes to play music, but I think sometimes, you know, someone from the outside thinks, well, there must be, you know, time to fool around and that, but there really isn't. They come in
not,
and they
not a lot of social
they get
life
there and they sit down and everyone's just very businesslike about it, and they play and they stop at a certain time and everyone rushes off because the time is so short, you know.
And this only describes the time people spend rehearsing as a group.
Oh,
people must work as individuals. They have to learn
practice
the music
at home and take the music home in between.
Right.
And so there's a lot of time that goes into it.
I think sometimes our imaginations don't extend into all of the private time that is.
I think we sometimes don't thank the musicians enough, you know, for what effort they do put forth to bring forth these wonderful concerts that we do have.
Well, there was such a long period of continuity of leadership if Sigvald Thompson was there for 37 years. But probably the biggest change that occurred was at the time he retired and stepped down. And would you like to talk about that?
Yes. Well, when Sig, he kind of felt that, you know, he never played down music to anyone. He felt that if people heard good music and heard it well played, and heard it often enough, they would just grow to like it. And as a result, he was always concerned with the quality. He was always concerned with having new works, contemporary music that he felt people should be exposed to, and he started this many years before a lot of orchestras in this country did. It was something he started back in the 40s. He performed compositions of local people even in the 40s already, and as time went on, he developed a commissioning program, and they also other music that was new, and he always sort of wedged it in, sandwiched between other things that perhaps were more appealing to the majority of listeners. But in that way, he was able to successfully carry through the development of having new music compositions in the orchestra repertoire. And I think his striving for quality and for varied programming, I think he had a... Well, he had usually start out with an overture and then some maybe shorter piece, a guest artist work, maybe it might be a concerto or a song cycle or something. And as time went on, symphony at the beginning, they only did movements of the symphonies, but as they got a larger orchestra and a more developed orchestra, they start playing whole symphonies, and I believe then from then on there have been a lot of whole symphonies that have been performed. And that programming seems to have worked very well. Well, when he retired, I think there was a great deal of concern what was going to happen to the orchestra, and so the search committee, which was a very excellent committee of the board, spent a lot of time trying to see, you know, what they should be looking for. They talked to many people. They talked to American Symphony Orchestra League about what they should be looking for, and opened it up to people all over the country. But when they went through all the applications and that they got in, I think they found that they had someone right here at home that seemed about as well qualified as anyone they had applications on. And that was J. Robert Hansen. And he was the principal trumpet player at in the symphony at this time. He had come here in 66 to teach at Concordia, and he had the Concordia band, and he had just started to develop the Concordia orchestra, and then he was the trumpet principal trumpet. And so they asked him if he would consider becoming conductor, because they felt he was so well qualified. He had he was a Concordia graduate, and he had gone on to the University of Iowa and finished his PhD, and he had played with the Tri-City Symphony and also with the Milwaukee Symphony, and had taught at the University of Iowa, and he had tremendous background, plus the background that he already had up here. So when he took over, this was in 1974, he continued many of the innovations that Sieg had already put in effect and has continued to build on them. And there has been a tremendous growth. Part of that growth was that when he took over in 74, it was also a growth period for the three colleges in music, mm-hmm. in the music departments. And all of them had brought in a number of new faculty teachers in the music field. And so the orchestra itself that year in professional musicians increased tremendously. And of course, immediately, obviously, with that many more new professionals, the quality, of course, just jumped very greatly at that time. And it since has continued to grow in that area. As I said, there are over 50% now. And I think with his very able leadership and with the infusion of new professional musicians, and of course that also stimulated many new students coming in who, because of having new faculty, who had new students and that, I think that the orchestra has grown just tremendously in quality and has been able to do works that they might not have even considered mm-hmm. years ago. I was thinking of the Mahler symphonies. To do a Mahler symphony is a tremendous undertaking, and you need a large, large orchestra, at least 100 members and that. And you could not do that 20, 30 years mm-hmm. ago. You know, you just didn't have the capacity to do it. So I think that, that has really been a tremendous advantage to our local orchestra. And in the process also has been the fact that the budget has grown tremendously. Mm-hmm. There have been new appeals as the orchestra continued to grow. You could appeal on a different scale, and in doing that you were able to develop a greater budget, which allowed you to do things too and spend money for things that you could not spend mm-hmm. for before. I think that I read somewhere that the original budget in 1931 was like $193 in some sense or something like that, or $192. And then it increased like to about $6,000 or $7,000 in the early 50s. And when I started, it was somewhere between $19,000 and $20,000. And in the late 70s, it was already going over 100,000. Well, when I left, we were a little over 190,000. So we really have come a long way from that $192.
Yes, that is an astounding record of some kind of growth.
But of course, originally all of the monies were from just contributions and small contributions, mm-hmm. and people just being asked, will they cover expenses for this and for that? And but later, the symphony board reorganized in 1954. And in that was because they wanted to do a really an expanded business drive, and they felt they couldn't without reorganization on the board to try to do set it up for that type of a regular official fund drive, so to speak, because that was not part of the original constitution. Mm-hmm. And so in reorganizing to gain more business support, they strengthened the board. They made it much more diversified. Originally, Hilder Shaw became president at the very beginning, and she was president until 1954 when they had the reorganization. And it was mostly made up of people that she knew, you know, would work on the board. And she was a wonderful, she was a person, she was very enthusiastic and very insistent on people helping her. And but it was really on a much smaller scale that you can do than when you organize in such a way that you're going to have a major fund drive and that type of thing. And to get the business people, they had to expand the board to include business people, because that, you know, you need to have peer group working with peer group. And so it there was a tremendous shifting. I think I can't remember how much they expanded, but I think they went to 21 members, which was much larger than they had had before, and had, you know, set up a constitution where they had committees and that type of thing. And as a result, I think that's during the 50s, it was the stabilizing effect of getting into the business area and that, that really helped. Well, in the 60s, when I first came in 67, we had just been granted our first State Art Council funding. North Dakota had received a block grant, their first block grant, which was something a little over $13,000, I think. And they were begging people to take advantage of applying for these funds. And this area, of course, being relatively conservative, were really shy of doing that because they didn't want interference from government on that type of thing. And they were very afraid that if the art groups start getting this money, they would be told what they should do and they shouldn't do. And they were quite independent. And one can understand their hesitancy, although later it has proven that the NEA certainly has not, they've set guidelines, but they certainly have not interfered with development of programming or anything else that, you know, the art organizations would like to do. So we got our first grant, which was to inaugurate a new commission program. It was a competition that we were going to have, and I think we offered $2,500, in fact, that's all we got. We got $1,000 to handle $2,500 awards for two compositions that were just from the 10 upper Midwest states, composers who were writing in the 10 upper Midwestern states. And that proceeded for many years, although later we did apply. After the first year, I realized we had a lot of expenses, and we hadn't applied for that. So the next time I applied for not two, but one grant with all the expenses so we could cover the costs, because that was something we had not anticipated, I guess, and helped to cover some of the concert programming and the publicity, extra publicity. And that has become a very highly successful program for the symphony over the years. We've had, we did this all the way through until the 50th anniversary in 81-82, and that year we decided to open it up nationally. And we did it partly to kind of revitalize it a little bit, to get other new input. And we also increased the amount of the award. And that year we gave a special award of $1,500. We had been giving $1,000 in the previous years and covered some expenses of copying and some travel expense. Because
did that funding always come through grant monies?
That came always. We used for the grant money, what we did is we used the grant money for the award and the travel expense and the copying costs. And then it came through our, at first it came in through a specific grant, but gradually in North Dakota we start getting general grants, and that was part of the general grants. When we wrote the grant up, we would say so much money was going to be used for this competition. When I left in 1984, they were just going to change, I think the first year, that was the 84-85 season, was going to offer the award every other year. And it would be at a $2,000 award basis, which I thought was really would also help give a new impetus to that kind of a competition. And the idea was that by doing it every other year and giving the higher award, they'd again be able to maybe upgrade compositions, although they've had very good compositions, and some of the people that have won have done a lot in music after they had won our competition. And then they used the alternate years. I think they were hoping that they would be able to extend a commission to someone who was not necessarily a national composer or nationally known so much as he just might be a well-established, a less-known national composer or a well-established regional composer. And they thought that would also give them more variety in their programming. And then in addition to that, every once in a while, you know, the symphony has another commission program where they extend a commission to a very well-known national composer that has been a marvelous asset to the programming. The last one being in the anniversary year when a commission was extended to Dominic Argento, who is a Minnesota composer, but of course is just one of the hottest classical composers in the country.
He has a world reputation.
Yes, he really has. And what was so fortunate about that particular commission was that it was completely underwritten by John and Constance Bowler, and we couldn't have handled it, I don't think, if they hadn't agreed to underwrite the whole cost, because it was a very expensive commission. But we've had just Gunther Schuller and Ernst Krennic and Jean Gouche and Ross Lee Finney, who used to live in Valley City when he was young. There just have been a number of excellent top commissions, and I'm sure that the symphony will continue this kind of programming because it's exciting and it's stimulating to the orchestra to play, and it's really good for the audience to hear works of that kind. And I think we've done a I just feel that in that's one area where we've just have been far ahead of many other orchestras of our size and caliber and being able to do all of these new programs. In fact, many times when you go to meetings, people say, well, how do you get the people to listen to that? And I've never felt it's been an effort to listen to that kind of programming, the way it's put together by the conductor and artistic director. You know, he manages to do it so well that people don't really feel that they're being imposed upon. Although I have been at concerts like in Chicago now where people just get up and walk out. I just couldn't believe it, I think, the first time I've seen that they don't like it. They just get up and leave, you know. They listen to the classical part, and they're just not interested in that.
We maybe have a more respectful
Well, I think so.
Audience.
I think we're much wider. And I think many times Bob Hansen stops and explains a little bit about the music, and there's excellent program notes usually. We usually ask the composer to write something so that they're concerned. And the people have a treat. When the young Japanese composer a few years ago had won the competition, he had brought two of his Japanese musicians here just to play a certain part of this work, and they put on a little concert of their own, if you remember.
I remember that.
And it was just exciting, you know, because this is the kind of thing you very seldom see. And they did such a beautiful job as their little part of the programming that I think people just never have quite forgotten that.
Well, that is truly regional leadership, I think, in an innovative program that's been very successful. Another very successful program for the symphony has been its guest artist series. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, I'd like to talk about that. In the early years, I think they used to, they always had guest artists. I think even in the first concert, they had a guest artist, a singer from Ophelia Brunsvold. And they usually used mostly local people. for, I would say, most of the 30s and 40s. And but they were always good musicians. I think we tend to forget that we do have very good artists here. You don't have to go somewhere else to really get high caliber artists. And we had some very fine artists. In fact, a number of them went on to become nationally or internationally known from here. So that I don't think that that just because we didn't have outside artists at the beginning, it certainly didn't detract from the programming. They used a lot of the faculty people from the schools who were always glad to have that opportunity. And they used other people in the community I remember one time they had two pianos. They did the Carnival of Animals, and Marge Gogstetter, I remember, played the piano. And, she does very well herself in her music. And then they started, I think as their budget became bigger, they started adding maybe an outside person or two. They had like 1 to 3 concerts a year, I think, in the 30s and 40s, and then they started expanding it a little bit in the 50s, late 50s and 60s. But they, maybe if they had 4 concerts, they might have 2 outside artists and a local artist, maybe 1 just all symphony concert. And some of these people, again, when I looked back on some of the names, are names that are nationally recognized now. They were people, though, at that time who were probably just coming up the ladder because obviously the budget wasn't high enough to be able to go out and book someone that was just had a big reputation at that time. But as time went on, when I came in, we really started making an effort. We had kind of fallen down on attendance, I think, in the year I came. It seemed to me like the couple of years, the attendance had not been like it had been in the 50s. There were a number of reasons for that. TV was interfering. There were a number of other art organizations that were developing, which of course was competitive. We in the early 50s were really all by ourselves here in the community, and we, when we put on something, everybody came out for it. But as more things start developing, we started to get the community theater that became stronger, and all the other, the schools started on with their Lyceum series and that. All of this started to, make us concerned that we needed to do something also to keep in the field. And so we thought, well, we would try perhaps to bring in at least 1 major outside artist and somebody who at least had a good name. We used before that time a lot of Leventritt Foundation people, which were young artists who were on the way up, and many of them, as I said, have become nationally known now. But they were unknowns at that time, but you could get them very reasonably. They were, when you got them, you maybe paid $200 or $300, and the foundation paid the rest. So we were never paying what it would cost to have them come out here. And but as we decided we would experiment more and started to sign up with some of the larger booking agencies and start bringing in people that we thought would be drawing cards, and that became kind of exciting because we were dealing with some of the bigger agencies. And I think as we did this, we realized we didn't have enough budget to keep expanding this area, so we talked about, well, why didn't we start charging for tickets? And this was a very difficult thing to do because the symphony had free concerts for years. It was sort of a tradition. People contributed money thinking, well, they didn't have to pay for concerts, so they were very generous with their giving. And we were, I think, at the time, probably the strongest and the most stable financial art group in the community because we had a very firm contributing base. And so it was very difficult. Well, as we also started getting into grants, the grantors were saying to us, well, why aren't you charging our concerts? You know, if you want more income, this is one way to do it. And we tried to explain, well, we had such a tremendous base of support through the community, through contributions, we did not want to sacrifice that just for selling tickets. So finally, by 1977, we had decided the time had come, we had to do something if we were going to be able to continue growth. And it was agreed that we would not do it by plunging right in, because we did not want to use that base of support. So we would do it by having one concert for that was paid 1 year, and the next year go to two, and increase it one every year until we got all of our major concerts covered. That would be five, so we could have a five subscription series concerts eventually. And we did that. The first person we brought in, and that sort of a little anecdote tell about that, we had planned to have the Romeros Quartet come in. They were guitarists who were very popular at the time, and we thought, well, they would be just a great group to come in because they would appeal to the general public. It wouldn't just be just to our regular concert-going group, and we wanted it to be successful. So we had, you know, put all kinds of publicity out and indicated there would be a charge for it, and tried to explain to all of our contributors, you know, that we were trying to do this because we needed extra money, but we felt that this one would not hurt, you know, our contributing base. We did have some feedback there. You know, people felt, oh, you know, Symphony had always had free concerts. Why couldn't they continue this way? But we knew that that would have to be something if we wanted to continue growth, we would do that. Well, it turned out that the first, I think it was Monday, of this concert, which was on the following weekend, we got a call and saying that they were not going to be able to come.
Oh, dear.
And
not at all. But there are four brothers.
There were four brothers, yes. And they wouldn't, well, I think the father and three brothers.
Father.
And they weren't going to be able to come. But they could have Aniel Romero come. He could come, but the other, I guess there was sickness in one of the families, and of course they only played certain works as a quartet, and they didn't do much as a trio. They had a duo, but they thought maybe they should send Aniel, who they thought was their best player at that time. Well, of course we didn't have any music or anything, and it was just, you know, well, what were we going to do? You know, the orchestra had been planning, this was their final week of rehearsals, and they told us, well, they thought we could maybe get some music from Boston. And I remember we called Boston, and the librarian, bless his heart, said, well, yes, he'd see that he'd put it on the plane that night, and hopefully we'd get it for the rehearsal on Tuesday. Well, we did. And so here this orchestra had to change all their music.
Oh, my.
And, of course, most of the program was, you know, based on that, at least a good half of it. And so all they had to learn all new music, and everybody really worked hard. And then the day of the concert came, and we had a wonderful turnout. And so we were really pleased because we thought, well, here, you know, we had ticket sales, and here, yeah, we were selling all these tickets. And we had talked to the booking agent, and they said, well, just, you know, have them go on, and we'll take care of all the adjustments, you know. Well, he said, well, he wasn't going to go on until we agreed to pay him exactly what, you know, they were to be paid as a group. And I said, well, you know, I didn't feel that was our decision. You know, that was something the booking agent had said they would handle. No, he wouldn't go on. So here it was like 3 minutes before the concert started. He wasn't dressed. He wouldn't dress. And he said, well, he just wasn't going to do anything, you know. And I thought, well, we just had to go ahead. So I said, well, let's just go ahead, and then I'll just take it up with them. Figured they'd have to make the adjustments if there were any. So we agreed, and then he finally got dressed. I didn't think we'd even have a concert, you know. But he was a, I would have to say, a very, he was a very determined young man. And but he played a beautiful concert. He was a beautiful, beautiful guitarist, and I think the audience was just captivated by him. Did you hear
yes,
that?
Yes, I remember that. It was wonderful. Yeah. And I catch the Romero brothers individually or sometimes as a group on recordings on public radio a lot, and I always can visualize
when I hear them, I always see him just saying, well, he just
I'm sure.
dressed, you know. But right. It was, you know, I guess I knew that he probably knew that I would say yes anyway, but I guess, you know, it kind of threw me because I'd never had anything turn up like that. But anyway, that was our first charged concert on a regular basis, and then we went to two the next year in that, and we, I think, decided later that we had done the right thing because we lost no base of support on our contributions and gained all this new money. So we felt that while we did it slowly and maybe it was not as fast as maybe some of the funding agencies would have liked, that we really felt we had accomplished what we wanted to, and that was to have contributors continue strong and give money to the orchestra for regular support, and then the ticket money was just all extra. And I think it has proved out. I think now they have over 1,000 subscribing members.
Isn't that remarkable?
And they still have a strong base of support.
Yes.
You know, so.
Well, that shows real sensitivity, mm-hmm. I think, to a community kind of response
effort. We did five and all of a sudden came out with, you know, saying they had to buy five tickets in addition. We really thought we would hurt ourselves, mm-hmm. and I think we felt that we did it well. And
mm-hmm.
and every year, you know, we got this extra money. It was a little bit more than the year before. And then when we went to five, we were really pleased that people continued to buy and yet still continued to contribute. There were a few. The only ones that really had stopped contributing or stopped, and it was people who had to make a choice between, because of their limitation of funds, between getting tickets and going to the symphony or, you know, not contributing. Mm-hmm. And there were a few who had to do that and wrote mm-hmm. us very honestly and said that, you know, mm-hmm. said, well, you know, we bought tickets, but we just feel we can't contribute.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we felt those people were still contributing in their way.
Let's talk for a minute about other support groups. You've talked about a strong board and how much leadership that has provided. You've talked a little bit about support through state and federal arts agencies. Another important group, it would seem to me, is the Women's Association.
Well, the Women's Association is a very vital arm of the symphony. They organized in 1955 in response to feeling that more programming for youth should be developed, and there just weren't the funds to do it. And so the Women's Association said, well, we will, you know, undertake trying to develop some youth programs, like to work up materials for concerts, if there were concerts given, and to have a ball that would raise extra money, and that money would be used for youth programs. And so they, after they organized in 55 with Barbara Vogel, Mrs. Phil Vogel was the first president, and I thought it was kind of cute. I think the organizing group met in G. Wilson Hunter's home, and they were quite a nice group of people there, but no one wanted the presidency, so Barbara wasn't there, and they just nominated or elected her in absentia, which I thought was kind of funny.
Pretty tricky.
Tricky, yeah. But she was good about it and went ahead and had that. And so they had the ball the following December, and that, of course, has become very traditional. And the ball, you know, raised a fair amount of money originally, and I think they got to maybe where they were raising like sometimes $2,000, $3,000. But they couldn't get beyond that because the ball, if you raise money just by tickets and that, you have a limit. They did have, in the early years, they did have a number, each ball, they had, of course, usually two ball chairmen, and they made had committees that made all kinds of handmade articles. This was before churches and that had a lot of bazaars. And then they would sell those, and that, of course, produced some money. But it wasn't a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. And so when they cleared $2,000 or $3,000, they thought they were doing pretty well. Well, as all the churches started having all their fall bazaars and that, they really realized, you know, to come up with new ideas and things that would sell was really not too easy. And it was suggested, Audrey Baird came out here from the American Symphony League, and she was at one of the luncheons, and she was singing and dancing and trying to tell people, you know, how they needed to do things. And she was a real inspiration. And I think she said, now you people, she said, you have this ball, and you're spending so much energy, and you're just making, you know, a couple of $1,000s. She said, why don't you put an auction to it and really start raising some money? And so the next year, the ball committee decided to, instead of making all kinds of things for sale, they would just have an auction. And they were very successful at it. And I think the first year they got maybe about $7,000 or $8,000. The next year they went up to $10,000. And I think last year they were up over $15,000. And so I think... that's including the ball tickets, but just between the ball and the auction, they have been raising a tremendous amount of funds, and which is a big change from the insecurity that they had before, where it was mostly based on the ball tickets. And of course, with food prices and that, you don't make that much on tickets anymore. You know, the ticket prices, the tickets are not, you can't add that much more to make that much kind of money on it. And of course, all of these marvelously donated auction items, you know, like a trip to London and that, they, you know, that's clear whatever they get auctioned off mm-hmm. for, and it really has helped them. Well, the Women's Association also had, besides the ball, which is their main money maker, they do a number of other things. They started a young artist competition a couple of years ago, and that was for high school students who were in grades, I think, 10 through 12, to play in a competition, and they have materials go out early in the fall to all the teachers, music teachers, and in the high schools, and also to regular music teachers, so they're aware of it. And that has been very successful, and they've had some marvelous young artists, and they usually play at the children's concerts and like at the Women's Association fall luncheon. And so they have several playing opportunities, and sometimes they play at the junior high if it's the kind of thing that they can play at. I think you heard at the luncheon,
yes,
the young trombonist,
yes,
who I think everybody just was had their mouths drop open when she played, because she's just a marvelous player.
Remarkable.
I just thought she was great for being a junior.
Mm-hmm.
Just thought, boy, somebody's going to, colleges will want to grab her. And then they also have a scholarship fund that they usually give a scholarship, what they call a Sigvald Thompson Memorial Scholarship, to a string player in the orchestra. And they have the youth concerts. I think last year they tried 3 youth concerts in one day, which was an increase from what they've had before. They had 2... I think one in the morning, one in the afternoon, one in the evening, and the one in the morning and afternoon, they had many students bust in. They've worked, I've been working with the Fargo schools, and it's a very well-organized thing. And then the evening, I think they charged admission. And that was something new, because they had not charged admission before that. We've always had some transportation grant money from North Dakota for busing, but we had a hard time. If you let them in free, we felt we could hardly charge them when we were being paid for their transportation. We just felt, you know, it was hard to do it, but I think they're they're trying to develop that so that it's more self-sustaining. And they help at the office on all kinds of volunteer activities, mailings and addressing, and that. And they help at receptions, and they run the Symphony Store, which has been also another moneymaker for them, and they've done very well on that Symphony Store. And that has at all the concerts and all the activities that they have. So, you know, they really have expanded tremendously in the years that since they've started in 55.
I didn't realize that the change to an auction had increased their income so dramatically. That's very interesting.
Oh, it was a very dramatic, very dramatic thing. And it's a lot of work, you know. Mm-hmm. The ball committees probably work harder than, you know, a concentrated work, you know, in the fall, just constantly having to be on top of it. And, like, even the auction committee has to spend a lot of time soliciting and getting all of these lined up in that. But I think they always feel very good, and they are always different. One year I know they had, like, an oil well for sale, and I guess a group...
Did a group buy it?
Yeah, a group went together and bought it as a joint venture, you know, and things like that. One wondered, how could... They kind of had a minimum ceiling. Mm-hmm. And they've had some things that have been given to them at cost, that they have to provide the cost, and then they get the difference. Mm-hmm. But most of them are just straight outright gifts that are... businesses are willing to contribute, and those businesses, many of them, are also contributing to the drive, to the regular fund drive. So they're double giving in many cases. Well, last year, I guess Dayton's gave a very large Indian artifacts that they had used, I think, in their display purposes and shows, and they had a very large group of artifacts, authentic artifacts that were very expensive, and they gave them to the symphony to be used for that purpose. I know the symphony realized a great deal of funds from that.
Well, traditionally, the events organized by the Women's Association have always been done with so much attention to detail and excellence and style.
They are.
Real contribution to the quality of community life.
They're elegant.
Absolutely. Our time is running short, and I just want to make another comment. In 1984, you were elected as the recipient for the YWCA.
That was such an exciting thing.
Woman of the Year in the arts.
I was really surprised. I guess I just didn't think I would get something like that, and it was just a very great honor, and I appreciate it.
It was certainly well earned, and small way for a community to say thank you for all the leadership you've provided. And I want to thank you for the Heritage Education Commission for participating in this oral history project and providing so much interesting information about the development and growth of the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony.
Well, it was fun.